Good morning. My name is Kent, and I am a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds. Reading this morning from the print edition of the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, April 24th, 2025, and beginning as usual on page one with What's News. What's News? Business and finance. Trump's softer stance on the Fed and trade with China lifted major U.S. stock indexes, with the S&P 500, NASDAQ, and Dow rising 1.7%, 2.5%, and 1.1% respectively. Boeing said it is actively looking to redirect planes that were slated to be sent to Chinese customers after China told its airlines to stop receiving orders from the aircraft maker. The European Union fined Apple and Meta platforms hundreds of millions of dollars and ordered the companies to comply with the bloc's technology rules. Southwest Airlines is suffering from a pullback in travel demand, and the carrier abandoned its full-year business projections in the face of uncertainty about the overall economy. Volvo cut its forecast for North America's truck market as the company reported a decline in deliveries for the first quarter. AT&T reported higher profit and revenue for the first quarter, boosted in part by an increase in acquired customers and a spur of upgrades in response to tariffs. Sullivan & Cromwell is beefing up its practice that defends corporations against shareholder activist attacks. The owner of Gucci and YSL posted lower first quarter sales, undershooting analyst forecasts amid a slowdown in luxury goods spending. Lysol maker Reckitt said the schedule for its plans to unload a portfolio of home care brands might lag because of market conditions. And worldwide, the Trump administration is considering slashing its steep tariffs on Chinese imports, in some cases by more than half, in a bid to de-escalate tensions with Beijing that have roiled global trade and investment. Higher tariffs and heightened geopolitical tensions may push government debts to new highs in coming years, putting pressure on policymakers, the International Monetary Fund said. Trump signed an executive order cracking down on foreign funding at universities, a key point of contention in the administration's battle with Harvard. Secretary of State Marco Rubio outlined a possible compromise with Iran aimed at preventing it from building a nuclear weapon. Talks to end the war in Ukraine are stalled, leaving Trump frustrated and blaming Zelensky for failing to accept a U.S. peace plan. Births in the U.S. hovered near record low rates last year, with the total fertility rate far below needed for a generation to replace itself. Senator Dick Durbin said that he won't run again, setting off a Democratic scramble in Washington and Illinois. Scientists sent quantum information across a record-breaking 158 miles using ordinary computers and fiber optic cables in advance toward better encryption. And disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein is back on trial on sex crime charges after his prior conviction was overturned. And we'll stay on page one for the lead article in the paper this morning, an exclusive to the Wall Street Journal, and the article is entitled Why Trump Decided Not to Try to Fire Jerome Powell. It's written by Brian Schwartz, Josh Dossi, and Nick Timrose. Dateline Washington. President Trump said this week that he never had any plans to fire Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, accusing the media of pushing a false narrative that he was out to get the central bank chief. But inside the White House, some senior officials took Trump's recent public musings about terminating Powell seriously. As Trump's criticism of the Fed chair ramped up over the last week, White House lawyers privately reviewed legal options for attempting to remove Powell, including whether they could do so for cause, according to people familiar with the matter. The laws that created the Federal Reserve say Fed governors can only be removed before their term ends for cause, which courts have generally interpreted to mean malfeasance or impropriety. Finding a pretext for dismissing Powell would have edged the White House closer to a dramatic confrontation with the central bank. Those discussions came to a halt early this week when Trump told his senior aides that he wouldn't try to oust Powell. His decision came after interventions from Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, who warned Trump that such a move could trigger far-reaching market chaos and a messy legal fight, the people said. Lutnick also told the president that efforts to fire the Fed chair likely wouldn't lead to any practical change on interest rates because other members of the Fed's board would likely approach monetary policy similarly to Powell, one of the people said. On Tuesday afternoon, Trump put the matter to rest, for now. He told reporters gathered in the Oval Office that he has no intention of firing Powell, softening the sharp rhetoric that he had repeated just one day before. This is a perfect time to lower interest rates. If he doesn't, is it the end? No, it's not, Trump said. The president has a terrific team of advisors that give him counsel on numerous topics, but at the end of the day, the president is the final decision maker, White House spokeswoman Taylor Rogers said, declining to comment on Trump's private conversations. Treasury Department and Commerce Department spokespeople didn't respond to requests for comment. Trump came into office promising a blunt and potentially painful rewiring of the global economy. But as markets have revolted against his aggressive trade and economic moves, the president has responded with climb downs and accommodations. In addition to backing off his market-rattling threats to oust Powell, Trump on Tuesday signaled a new willingness to lower steep tariffs on China. The twin walkbacks come after he paused many of his proposed tariffs for 90 days. Trump's comments this week reassured jittery investors who were panicking about the president's aggressive rhetoric, and they showed that despite the president's insistence that he isn't fazed by the ups and downs of the markets, he and his advisors are paying close attention to how Wall Street and major corporations respond to his agenda. Trump continues to track the markets closely, a senior administration official said. On Monday, Trump met at the White House with senior executives from the country's biggest retailers, including Target, Walmart, and Home Depot. They told the president that his tariffs, particularly the duties he placed on China, could raise prices for customers, a person familiar with the conversation said. A day later, Trump told reporters that the 145% tariffs on Chinese imports were very high and would come down substantially. Administration officials are discussing how much lower the tariff should be, according to people familiar with the matter. Tesla CEO Elon Musk, a senior Trump advisor who leads the Department of Government Efficiency, said during an earnings call on Tuesday that he would advocate for lowering tariffs in his conversations with the president. Whether he will listen to my advice is up to him, said Musk. The billionaire said that he would devote less time to his work with Doge amid sliding at Tesla, which took a reputational hit from Musk's association with the administration. Most Wall Street analysts believe attempting to remove Powell before his term ends wouldn't get the president the lower rates that he wants because there is no support on the central bank's 12-person rate-setting committee to reduce interest rates right now. The Fed cut rates by 1 percentage point last year because inflation had declined and they didn't want to risk an unnecessary recession. Tariffs have frozen up Fed officials who worry they will push up prices and introduce new risks of higher inflation, even if they later chill spending and hiring that weakens the economy. One illustration of the challenge the president faces in getting the Fed to lower rates, Trump last month elevated a Fed governor that he appointed during his first term, Michelle Bowman, to serve as the vice chair for bank supervision. Bowman has been one of the most outspoken officials to warn against the risks of lowering interest rates too soon or too fast. The Fed's operational autonomy, or its independence, has long been viewed as sacrosanct by bond investors on Wall Street. Some foreign investors could be less likely to buy U.S. Treasury securities, leading to higher interest rates, if they feared that the American government would tolerate higher levels of inflation by telling the central bank how to set interest rates. The market reaction to successfully forcing out the Fed chair would be apocalyptic. Tim Mahady, chief economist at Access Micro, who was a senior advisor at the San Francisco Fed, wrote in a note to clients last week. He predicted the pain would be so swift and severe that the president would be forced to walk it back immediately or face a systemic financial event. Powell has consistently said he doesn't believe the Fed's independence will be compromised. That arrangement is very widely understood and supported in Washington, in Congress, where it really matters, he said during a talk in Chicago last week. While Trump regularly made similar threats against the Fed in 2019, investors viewed the recent squabble as different for two reasons. First, Trump has been far more willing to defy institutional and legal norms than in his first term. The Justice Department is seeking to overturn a 90-year legal precedent that many legal experts believe provides the strongest guardrail against removing Fed officials from office before their terms expire. Second, inflation could be a bigger problem this year because Trump's tariffs are much larger and broader than those he imposed in his first term. That is threatening a more difficult trade-off for the Fed, which in recent years lifted interest rates to a two-decade high to fight inflation. Powell has viewed the unsavory prospect of a legal showdown, one he might have to pay for out of his own pocket, as imperative to preserve the ability of future Fed chairs to serve without the threat of being removed over a policy dispute. The Fed has guarded its independence to set monetary policy ever since the very high inflation of the 1970s. President Richard Nixon privately pressured his Fed chairman and former advisor, Arthur Burns, to ease policy ahead of the 1972 election, according to Oval Office recordings. Burns acceded. Years of high inflation were cured by a punishing recession in the early 1980s. While the Fed's independence wasn't enshrined in law after that, the experience led to a broader institutional understanding by presidents, Congress, and the Fed that the central bank should be granted a reasonable amount of deference to achieve the goals of keeping inflation low with a healthy labor market. Many other central banks in the 1990s sought and were granted considerable operational autonomy, or independence, by their governments to set interest rates with an eye toward the long-run good of the economy. And we'll stay on page one for the next article, also an exclusive to the paper this morning, entitled, White House Considers Slashing Trade Tariffs to De-Escalate Trade War. Levies could be cut by more than half in some cases, although Trump hasn't yet made final decision. It's written by Gavin Bade, Li-Ling Wei, Josh Dossi, and Alex Leary. The Trump administration is considering slashing its steep tariffs on Chinese imports, in some cases by more than half, in a bid to de-escalate tensions with Beijing that have roiled global trade and investment, according to people familiar with the matter. President Trump hasn't made a final determination, the people said, adding that the discussions remain fluid and several options are on the table. One administration official said Trump wouldn't act unilaterally and would need to see some action from Beijing to lower tariffs. One senior White House official said the China tariffs were likely to come down to between roughly 50% and 65%. The administration is also considering a tiered approach similar to the one proposed by the House Committee on China late last year. 35% levies for items the U.S. deems not a threat to national security, and at least 100% for items deemed as strategic to America's interest, some of the people said. The bill proposed phasing in those levies over 5 years. President Trump has been clear. China needs to make a deal with the United States of America. When decisions on tariffs are made, they will come directly from the president. Anything else is just pure speculation, White House spokesman Kush Desai said. Later on Wednesday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told reporters that Trump hasn't offered to take down U.S. tariffs on China on a unilateral basis, Bloomberg News reported. Trump said Tuesday that he was willing to cut tariffs on Chinese goods and that the 145% tariffs he imposed on China during his second term would come down. But it won't be zero, he said. The development was welcome news to investors who had been spooked by the White House's aggressive moves in recent weeks. China on Wednesday signaled it was open to trade talks with the U.S., though Beijing warned it wouldn't negotiate under continued threats from the White House. In China's policymaking circles, Trump's comments Tuesday were viewed as a sign of him folding, people who consult with Chinese officials said. Even if Trump decides to lower some tariffs on Chinese imports by half, that level would still mean the U.S. markets would be all but closed to many Chinese makers of electrical machinery and equipment and other products. Some analysts have estimated that trade between the two countries could dry up within months at such a high level. Some people close to the White House said Trump has plenty of room to lower the China tariffs and still work toward his administration's goal of decoupling the U.S. from the world's second-largest economy. It would be kind of a pressure valve release without actually doing anything, one of the people said. The expressions of openness to a deal from both sides represent a shift from much of the past month, as the world's two largest economies exchanged reciprocal tariff increases and testy words, helping push stock markets around the world to their worst weeks in many years. The administration had planned to use continuing tariff negotiations to pressure U.S. trading partners to limit their dealings with China, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Still, Bessent has said there is room for talks on a potential trade deal between the U.S. and China. Such negotiations would have to involve Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping, though the two haven't spoken since Trump regained the White House. As trade tensions have spiraled, Trump has indicated he would like Xi to call him. Trump officials have also suggested to Chinese diplomats that Foreign Minister Wang Yi reach out to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, according to people familiar with the matter. So far, Beijing has refused to engage on either front. A delegation of senior Chinese officials, including Finance Minister Lan Fuan and the governor of the People's Bank of China, Pan Gongsheng, are in Washington this week for the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. So far, they haven't scheduled any meetings with the administration and have scheduled to leave Washington Thursday, according to people familiar with the matter. But that can change if they get meetings with administration officials, the people said. And still on page one for the next article, 5-minute EV charging is here, but not for U.S.-made cars. And it's written by Yoko Kubota. Dateline Shanghai. Two of the world's leading battery developers are locked in a technological race that has brought the charging time for an electric vehicle to just 5 minutes, about the amount of time it takes to refuel a traditional gasoline-powered car. And, in a twist with geopolitical ramifications, both of the technological leaders are Chinese. It is a show of prowess that underscores just how far China has extended its global dominance over next-generation technologies, in some cases leaving the U.S. years behind. The claimed leap forward on EV batteries is merely the latest technological feat for a country that has stunned Western governments with a string of breakthroughs on artificial intelligence, semiconductors, and EVs, a vindication of leader Xi Jinping's ambitions of turning China into a global technological powerhouse. Contemporary Amperex Technology, the world's biggest automotive battery maker, said this week on the sidelines of Auto Shanghai, China's biggest auto show, that it had developed a new fast-charging system that, within 5 minutes, can power a car for 320 miles of driving. By getting the charging time down to roughly the same time as it takes to refuel a gasoline-powered car, the Ningde, China-based company known as CATL, appears to have further eroded a major obstacle to wider EV adoption. CATL's announcement came just after that of fellow Chinese battery maker BYD, which also manufactures its own EVs that rival Tesla's products. In March, BYD, based in the southern Chinese technology hub of Shenzhen, said that its new charging technology is capable of providing 250 miles of range in 5 minutes. The technologies won't be introduced on a wide scale right away. The batteries can only be charged at a network of super-fast charging stations that is still being built out. Still, CATL's and BYD's technologies serve as the latest example of how China is years ahead of the U.S. in EV technology, even as the Trump administration intensifies efforts to curtail Chinese companies' access to cutting-edge technology. China, under Xi, has long positioned EVs as a technological priority, while in Washington, concerns have grown among officials and lawmakers about energy security. Cat L is now responsible for making more than one-third of the EV batteries on the global market, including those made in inside made-in-China Teslas. Cat L and BYD's claimed technological advancements are unlikely to benefit American consumers, at least in the near term, given sky-high tariffs levied by the U.S. against Chinese goods, and in particular, EVs manufactured in China. It is a reminder of how divergent the automotive landscape and the consumer experience have become between China and the U.S., the world's two biggest economies and auto markets. Chinese electric cars are an exceedingly rare sight on U.S. roads because of tariffs that were already at around 100% last year under import taxes levied by the Biden administration. Then, in a string of recent moves, President Trump slapped additional tariffs on most Chinese goods, including cars, of 145%. Meanwhile, within China, Xi's top-down push has been broadly embraced by ordinary consumers, who are now as likely to buy electric and plug-in vehicles as traditional gas-powered cars, aided by relatively low electricity costs and a batch of consumption-related subsidies. In March, 52% of passenger cars sold in the country were battery electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, or range-extended vehicles, according to the China Passenger Car Association. As adoption rapidly increased in China, homegrown players came to dominate the global EV supply chain, including, crucially, batteries, perhaps the single most important technology underpinning EV performance. Many of these players got a big boost working alongside Tesla, the American EV pioneer that started making cars at its Shanghai plant in late 2019. Now, global dependence on Chinese battery suppliers, paired with concerns that Chinese EVs could flood overseas markets and pose a threat to domestic players, have raised alarms in the U.S. and other Western markets. In a bid to catch up, Ford Motor is building a battery plant in the U.S. where it plans to manufacture batteries using Cat-L technology. Chinese battery makers are leading producers of lithium iron phosphate, or LFP, batteries. These iron-based battery cells cost less than the nickel and cobalt combination used widely in North America and Europe. Cat-L's newest fast-charging battery, the second generation of its Shenzing lineup, is an LFP battery with a range of about 500 miles. Cat-L said it improved electron transmission efficiency to avoid overheating during rapid charging. How quickly such batteries will be adopted on a wide scale is another matter, because of the need to develop the charging infrastructure. BYD has said that it is working to build 4,000 compatible stations in China and that its charging system will be initially available only for two models, limiting its uptake in the near term. Li Hongqin, president of Chinese EV maker NIO, which uses Cat-L's battery cells and offers its own battery swap system, said car makers needed to see how quickly the rapid changing technology scales up, referring to the infrastructure build-out. There is still a big difference between theoretical calculations and practical applications, Chin said. Mike Dunn, who runs a namesake automotive consulting firm, said Cat-L's and BYD's superfast charging technologies are a genuine breakthrough, but several challenges remain. The new technology will cost more, and frequent usage will wear out the battery cells, he said. It's more sizzle than steak, Dunn said. China has more than 13 million EV charging facilities nationwide, counting both publicly and privately operated ones, state media has reported. The U.S. has around 77,300 charging stations, with about 230,000 EV charging points in total, data from the Joint Office of Energy Transportation showed. It is unclear if the two figures are directly comparable, but industry experts widely regard China's EV charging environment to be far ahead of the U.S.'s. Separately, on Monday, CATL introduced a new sodium-ion battery that it calls Nextra. At the moment, mainstream EV batteries are reliant on lithium, creating a potential bottleneck around supplies of the material. CATL says sodium-ion batteries, if mass-produced, could help reduce its dependence on lithium. Sodium-ion batteries are made from a sodium compound called soda ash, which can be produced using table salt. Unlike lithium, sodium is easily accessible everywhere. The U.S. has also been working on developing this technology. And we'll turn now to the business and finance section of the paper for the lead story. There today, entitled, "Huge Stock Swings Are the New Normal for Frazzled Investors." April is poised to be the most volatile calendar month since the COVID crash in 2020. The article is written by Gunjan Banerjee. Another day of big gains on Wall Street left investors saying one thing seems certain: the stock market's frenzied swings are here to stay. President Trump's softer stance on the Federal Reserve and trade with China sent share prices surging for a second consecutive session Wednesday, continuing a dizzying stretch for financial markets that has lifted major indexes well off their lows of the year. The trade war swings, both higher and lower, have left many investors on edge. The S&P 500 has gained or lost at least 1% in 7 of the past 10 sessions, and April is poised to be the most volatile calendar month since the COVID crash in 2020, according to Dow Jones market data. Many are betting that the mammoth moves for stocks will continue, given how sensitive investors across Wall Street are right now to morsels of news tied to tariff developments. That means moves higher might be just as jarring as the slides. "People are on alert for the next headline," said Chris Henteman, Chief Investment Officer of 400 Capital Management. "Whether it turns out to be a very big up day or a very big down day, it really limits people's ability to have confidence, to have capital out." The S&P 500 jumped 1.7%, while the tech-heavy NASDAQ composite gained 2.5%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average soared more than 1,000 points, then pared that climb to close up 419.59 points, or 1.1%. The gains were broad-based, lifting everything from technology behemoths to banks. Moves for some industrial stocks were even more dramatic, and shares of companies such as Boeing, Intel, and Supermicrocomputer jumped more than 5% apiece. Tesla shares added 5.3% even after the company reported late Tuesday that net income slid 71% in the first quarter, and Elon Musk said he would pull back from his work in the Trump administration. The volatility hasn't been limited to traditional trading hours, from 9:30 a.m. to the closing bell at 4 p.m. The good news for investors started trickling in late Tuesday when Trump said he didn't plan to fire Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. Anxiety about the central bank's independence had helped send stocks tumbling to start the week, and many were relieved that Trump said he wouldn't try to oust Powell, whose term ends next year. Almost immediately, futures tied to major indexes started rising in evening trading. Stocks got another boost Wednesday after the Wall Street Journal reported that the White House is considering cutting tariffs on Chinese imports by up to half, in some cases to de-escalate trade tensions with one of the country's major trade partners. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told a roomful of representatives from the finance industry that, despite Trump's trade war, the U.S. wants to work with its allies. The comments helped assuage investors who have been rattled by a nearly nonstop stretch of developments that threaten to dent the strong U.S. economy. Though the U.S. still has to negotiate trade agreements with dozens of countries around the world, for now the worst-case scenario that many investors feared after Liberation Day seems to have dissipated. Highlighting the volatility, however, stocks pared their early surge after the administration said there would be no unilateral reduction in tariffs against China. With markets hanging on every announcement Investors say they remain wary stocks could still retest their lows of the year. Dev Kantasaria, founder of Valley Forge Capital Management, said he views Trump's messaging on tariffs as part of a longer-term negotiation. "He's a consummate negotiator," Kantasaria said. "I don't let the short-term news take me away from understanding the bigger picture." Many others, from Wall Street to day trading hobbyists, have remained invested through the ups and downs. And with this week's rally, the S&P 500 has cut its losses for the year to 8.6% from around 15% at its low. Investors also hit pause on the Sell America trade that has triggered punishing sell-offs spanning American assets. Longer-term Treasury prices rose, dragging 10-year yields down for the second consecutive day to 4.385%. And the WSJ dollar index held broadly steady after regaining some ground Tuesday. An exchange-traded fund tracking stocks around the world, the Vanguard Total International Stock ETF, rose around 0.5%, lagging behind the S&P 500. Still, options traders are betting on a move of 1% or more, higher or lower, in the S&P 500 index for every session through at least May 23rd, according to a Monday note from Citigroup strategists. Those moves are expected to be higher on days of economic importance. Options are pricing in a swing of 1.8% in the benchmark index when the April jobs report is released, and a move of 1.7% the day of Powell's post-meeting press conference in May. We'd expect to see further violent upside rips as investors anchor and extrapolate from the latest data point, wrote Wolfe Research analysts in a note to clients. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Kent, and I'm a volunteer reader. Did you know that you can access any of our programs on demand, including the Wall Street Journal, of course, by simply going to our website at sunsounds.org, then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. And now, on to the next article, which is still in the Business and Finance section. And today it's the Streetwise column, which is entitled, "Markets Think They Hold All the Cards Over Trump. The plunge in stocks, bonds, and the dollar matter to Trump, but there's no assurance that he will be ruled by them." And the column is written by James McIntosh. The vital question for investors, did President Trump cave on tariffs and the Fed because the markets now have the whip hand? Is it because he has some grand plan behind the chaos? Or did he just talk to someone else? To be clear, I don't know. I can't make out a grand plan that explains the wild policy swings, but both market vigilantes and the Kremlinology of which advisors have access to the Oval Office on any given day seem like plausible explanations. On Tuesday and Wednesday, markets turned very positive, with stocks and the dollar up and Treasury yields and gold down. The rout in American assets stopped after Trump said he wouldn't fire Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, and the Wall Street Journal reported that tariffs on China could be halved. In short, Trump caved, at least for now. The case that Trump changed his mind because of the market reaction is easy to make and repeats his reversal 2 weeks ago when he delayed his so-called reciprocal tariffs after signs of serious trouble appeared in financial markets. This time, the dollar reached its weakest in 3 years, despite the sharp rises in bond yields, while gold hit new highs. Markets didn't like what Trump was saying on the Fed and doing with tariffs, and Trump didn't like how the markets reacted. For investors, this interpretation is reassuring, as it sets a limit on the dumbest ideas, akin to the bond vigilante reaction that ejected Liz Truss from her seat as British Prime Minister faster than a lettuce could wilt. The power of the markets isn't magical. Asset prices are just many people assessing the prospects for the economy and future returns, and concluding that neither 145% tariffs on China nor Trump interfering in setting interest rates would be good for them. Markets are a live opinion poll of money. In that sense, they matter to Trump, but there is no assurance that he will be ruled by them. Sometimes doing what's best for the country might be bad for stocks, tax rises, or bad for bonds, tax cuts, or bad for the dollar, rate cuts, or a war, for example. The combination of all three is different, though. The only policy I can think of that would at least be arguably good for the country but bad for stocks, bonds, and the dollar all at once would be a new pandemic lockdown. Please, no. And even then, fiscal and monetary policy should be a major offset. The triple plunge typically means capital flight is underway, something no government should be pleased by. Britain experienced this in 1976, an ignominious year when stocks, bonds, and the pound all fell until the new prime minister called in the International Monetary Fund to stop a fiscal crisis. Countries that ignore capital flight eventually end up isolated and poor. Think Venezuela or Zimbabwe. The U.S. is a long way from this sort of catastrophe, but I'm hopeful that the markets have imposed some limits on what Trump is willing to do. That's good for investors, but comes with three big caveats. First, don't assume that Trump has put a floor under prices. The S&P 500 low earlier this month of 48.35 wasn't the key, nor was the ICE U.S. dollar index below 100, or even the 30-year Treasury yield approaching 5%. If it was the markets forcing a reversal, it was probably the signs of capital flight, that is, the simultaneous losses, not some sort of Trump put in stocks or sensitivity to a particular bond yield. Second, it shows just how much risk Trump is willing to take before reversing. It should be obvious that attacking the Fed's independence would hurt markets, yet he did it anyway. It should be obvious that imposing 145% tariffs on your biggest supplier of goods would hurt markets, yet he did it anyway. If prices have to fall hard before he drops his next market-unfriendly plan, that's cold comfort for investors during the fall. Third, this all rests on the assumption that Trump reversed course because of the markets, and we can't be sure that's true. Trump might talk to a different advisor next time, or he might be making it up as he goes along. Investors shouldn't get complacent about their supposed hold over the president. We'll continue in business and finance for the next article, which is Southwest Airlines drops forecast as leisure travelers pull back. Dallas-based carrier facing challenges in projecting passenger demand and overall economic conditions. It's written by Allison Sider. A pullback in travel demand is hurting Southwest Airlines, and the airline dropped its full-year business projections given uncertainty about the overall economy. The airline on Wednesday pulled its estimates for earnings before interest and taxes for 2025 and 2026, but affirmed that new initiatives to improve its financial performance are still on track. Southwest reported a net loss of $149 million in the first quarter, a contrast to rivals United Airlines and Delta Airlines that posted profits for the first 3 months of the year. On an adjusted basis, Southwest's loss of 13 cents a share was smaller than the 18 cents a share loss analysts were expecting. The carrier said its first quarter revenue was a record, but demand weakened throughout the quarter and sales softened, particularly for domestic leisure travel. Southwest shares fell 4% in after hours. The stock closed regular trading Wednesday up 3.1% to $25.52 a share. Airlines that started the year with high hopes have faced a murkier outlook amid fear that the U.S. economy will face slower growth, higher inflation, and a greater risk of recession. Delta ditched its guidance for the year, citing the uncertainty. United offered two forecasts for two different economic scenarios, but said it expects to post profits no matter what. Southwest on Wednesday joined Delta and United, saying that it expects to slow growth in the second half of the year. Waning consumer confidence and fears of a broader economic turndown have left big airlines relying even more on wealthy customers who are willing to spend more to sit in premium seats. Those trends leave Dallas-based Southwest in a difficult spot, unable to take advantage of the strategies that are still working well for other airlines. It doesn't fly to far-flung overseas destinations in Europe and Asia, places Americans still want to travel, and it has lagged behind in offering more high-end experiences customers are willing to pay up for. Southwest is in the process of converting its planes to add extra legroom sections and doing away with its hallmark open seating and unique boarding process in hopes of convincing passengers to open their wallets. Next month, Southwest plans to start charging many customers for check bags, a seismic shift that provoked sharp outcry from the airline's fiercely loyal clientele. The carrier hasn't yet said what the fees will be. Tony Roach, the airline's executive vice president of customer and brand, acknowledged that customers were disappointed by the policy change, but said in an interview that the announcement hasn't resulted in a dramatic change in bookings. Since Southwest last year faced down an activist investor, its management has gone through an overhaul, with some senior executives, like its longtime chief financial officer, departing. And the carrier earlier this year announced plans to cut costs by eliminating 1,750 corporate jobs in its first mass layoff, a blow to its storied culture. And we'll turn now to the op-ed section of the paper for an editorial this morning, which is titled, Trump's Ukraine Ultimatum. The president puts pressure only on one side, not on Russia. And it's written by the editorial board. President Trump on Wednesday unleashed another broadside against Ukraine, and his dislike for President Volodymyr Zelensky isn't news. But what matters to U.S. interests and Mr. Trump's presidency are the terms of a negotiated settlement. Mr. Trump's current offer looks more like an ultimatum than grounds for a durable peace. We've issued a very explicit proposal to both the Russians and the Ukrainians, and it's time for them to either say yes or for the United States to walk away from this process, Vice President J.D. Vance said from India on Wednesday. Secretary of State Marco Rubio sounded similar notes last week, and by walking away, the administration seems to mean abandoning Ukraine to Vladimir Putin's designs. Stipulate that even Ukraine's ardent supporters understand the war will end in a negotiation. Ukraine won't regain all of its territory, as regrettable as that is for a country of free people who have resisted Mr. Putin with valor. The Biden administration squandered the chances for a strategic victory for Ukraine and the U.S. with its hesitant, fretful response to the 2022 invasion. But Mr. Trump also can't expect Ukraine to surrender and accept a peace on its knees. The administration has said Kyiv can't join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Never mind that the alliance would be stronger with Ukraine's military, now highly experienced on the battlefield. But even without NATO, Ukraine will need a security guarantee worth more than Mr. Putin's word. The Russian dictator has refused to accept a Ukraine armed by the West with European troops on its soil. Mr. Trump is angry that Ukraine won't accept a deal that legitimizes Russia's occupation of Crimea, as if this is a minor map revision. The U.S. refusal to credit territory seized by invasion is a principle intended to deter future marauders. Letting Russia keep its navy in Crimea is a threat to Europe as much as to Ukraine. A peace, or even an armistice, worth the name, requires compromise on both sides. But Mr. Trump has applied pressure only on Ukraine. Mr. Trump proposed a 30-day ceasefire, and Mr. Zelensky accepted. Mr. Putin simply blew off the proposal. Press reports say the Russian dictator is now pretending it's a concession to freeze the conflict along current lines, instead of demanding entire provinces it hasn't been able to seize. The lack of pressure on Mr. Putin is particular malpractice, as the Russian dictator is struggling to drum up more troops. Why would Mr. Putin compromise if he will pay no price for refusing, not even more U.S. arms for Ukraine after the current supply runs low this summer? Mr. Trump likes to say Ukraine doesn't have the cards, but it does have one ace. The president won't be able to abandon Ukraine without paying a heavy political price. As the historian and Stalin biographer Stephen Kotkin said in an interview recently, Americans hate war, but they hate losing a war even more. President Trump may prefer to focus on a nuclear deal with Iran or his trade war with China, but he won't leverage failure in Europe into success in Asia or the Middle East. A U.S. flag officer told Congress recently that China has provided 70% of the machine tools and 90% of the legacy chips that have allowed Russia to rebuild its war machine. And that's a testament to how the world's problems are now intertwined. Mr. Trump can still salvage a deal in Ukraine, but the current final settlement offer looks like it would set up Mr. Putin to win the war now or later. The world's rogues will notice, and Mr. Trump's headaches will have only begun. And a commentary piece this morning entitled, "A New Poll Shows the Peril of Trump's Tariffs." The president is doing well on other issues, but 84% of voters in a new survey say they favor free trade. And it's written by Mark Penn and Andrew Stein. President Trump has come out of the box swinging, aided by a new group of advisors and cabinet members dedicated to implementing his vision. The public is largely behind him. A new Capps-Harris poll conducted April 9 through 10 finds that 39% of voters say the country is on the right track, an increase of 11 points since January. Mr. Trump's personal job approval has so far peaked at 52% in February, and it is still at 48%, a healthy figure in a polarized country. His numbers have plenty of room to grow if he can unite more of the country around his largely popular agenda. His greatest political danger is his trade policy. Voters like Mr. Trump's immigration policy, with 74% saying they favor deporting illegal aliens who have committed crimes. There was never significant support for the Biden administration's policy of de facto open borders, which let 10 million people enter the country illegally. Huge majorities also support slimming down the government. 77% support a full examination of all government expenditures, and 81% think the U.S. should move in the next few years to balance the budget, a feat not achieved since Bill Clinton's presidency. Elon Musk has seen his ratings decline from positive to negative as he endures sustained attacks from Democrats. But underlying his work are some very popular goals, even if there are problems with public communication. There are deep passions on both sides, but a majority of Americans reject woke ideology. 65% of voters favor Mr. Trump's policy of banning males from women's and girls' sports, and 59% support eliminating all preferences by race in the hiring and awarding of government contracts. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has a 44% personal favorability rating, second only to Mr. Trump, 46%, among the 14 political figures included in the poll. His Make America Healthy Again campaign is likely to prove popular. The rub is Mr. Trump's tariffs, which generally confuse people. 84% of the poll's respondents say they favor free trade, but 66% agree that tariffs are important to protect jobs in our country today. One way of reconciling the tension between these positions would be to use U.S. tariffs as an incentive for other countries to reduce theirs. In this view, tariffs shouldn't become a permanent fixture, but be seen as a necessary evil to stop other countries, especially China, from taking advantage of Americans. So here is where Mr. Trump and public opinion diverge. He gets only 45% approval on his tariff plans and 41% on his efforts to curb inflation. He needs to improve these numbers as his presidency is at stake. America imports only about 11% of its goods, or about $3 trillion a year, in a $28 trillion economy. So in one sense, the hullabaloo over tariffs is overblown. A 10% tariff on all goods is only about 1% added cost to the economy, a small fraction of the 20% cumulative inflation the country experienced under Mr. Biden, and less than the cost of the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, with its trillions of dollars of subsidies. Nevertheless, imports are deeply woven into the production and retail processes of the country, which means prices will rise on domestically made goods too. This level of rapid dislocation has set off economic chaos. The president needs to do a far better job explaining his precise tariff goals, come up with lots of trade agreements quickly, or pull back and revamp the policy. Maybe there are some transition aid ideas, but they will be costly. Otherwise, he will suffer deteriorating ratings that could lead to a midterm election collapse as inflation becomes the number one issue and there already is full employment. A policy that raises prices and encourages employment is likely to put out a fire with gasoline. The Federal Reserve likely won't cooperate to lower interest rates against an inflationary policy, though in fairness, the central bank didn't seem to care about last year's massive increases in federal spending, which were as inflationary as tariffs. It takes about 48% of voters to get elected president, but it takes at least 55% to have 60% support when you govern. That means appealing to a lot of people who didn't vote for you, the key difference between campaigning and governing. All presidents succeed at getting elected, but many fail at governing. Presidents Reagan and Clinton understood all this and were the only two modern presidents with approval ratings above 60% as they left office. Mr. Trump has a lot of policies here that could catapult him into high popularity, but his tariffs, whether good policy or not, are dragging him down. He ignores that as his political peril. Mr. Penn was a pollster and advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton, 1995 to 2008. He is chairman of the Harris Poll and CEO of Stagwell, Inc. Mr. Stein served as New York City Council president from 1986 to 1993. And finally this morning, we'll go back to page one to read the AHED column in the paper today, which is entitled, "The Impossible Four-Hour Test You Need to Pass to Become a Tariff Pencil Pusher." And it's written by Esther Fung. Suddenly, everyone wants a piece of Nunzio De Filippis. He's a U.S. licensed customs broker, which means he handles the paperwork to process imports and calculate duties and fees for products brought into the country. It's a staggeringly tedious job that would be of little interest to anyone in normal times. But amid a flurry of new tariffs by the Trump administration that seem to change by the hour, brokers say they are fielding back-to-back calls from panicked importers who need help deciphering the shifting picture and minimizing the cost of getting their goods into the U.S. When DeFilippis and other brokers get overwhelmed, they remind themselves they already overcame a far more torturous ordeal, the customs exam. "I've always prided myself for being a good student, but when I got to that test, I was humbled," said DeFilippis, co-CEO of Cargo Trans, a freight forwarder and logistics service provider. "Even if you put in the hours, you have to learn how to beat the test." The 4.5-hour open book test covers the technicalities of classifying merchandise and entry and valuation procedures. Exam takers, who have to be U.S. citizens 18 years and older, said the 80 multiple choice questions are deliberately obfuscating. A minimum score of 75% is required to pass, but don't let the C-grade threshold fool you. The last six exams, which are held twice a year, have an average pass rate of 21% prior to appeal decisions. One exam in 2019 had a pass rate of 4.2%. "I knew I was in for it when they said it was open book," said Lori Geiger, who was taking the exam on April 23rd. "Open book is never a good thing. This exam won't include Trump's latest round of tariffs, which started in February. I have a master's degree from DePaul School of Business in real estate investment and finance, but this material is unlike anything I've ever encountered," said Geiger, director of business development at an air cargo company. She describes the exam as pure hell. Geiger is taking a month off work and has been holed up in her house or the library studying. She has missed a recent Mother's Weekend and her son's college and her daughter's volleyball tournament. On her desk are huge books and folders filled with thousands of pages of classification minutiae. "Skateboards are easy to classify. Bearings, a nightmare." Most consumers don't give that much thought about the supply chain when ordering online or buying a shirt in a store. But for each item, every stitch, label, fabric, quantity of fabrics, weight, button, whether it is a men's or women's shirt, how it was made, where it originated, packaging must be accounted for, said Geiger. On exam day, every minute counts. Candidates are allowed to bring one rolling crate or one suitcase and a shelf or rack into the exam hall to hold their reference material if they need more space than the provided desks. No electronics are allowed. You don't want to reach down to the ground for your notes, said Jess Kronover, who works at a customs brokerage and compliance firm. She studied for 8 weeks before taking the exam in 2021, bringing in a roller cart and stacked blank notebooks to prop up her reference material. She passed. I was really motivated, said Kronover. I'm never losing that license because I'm never taking that exam again. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the agency that administers the exam, said it gets an average of about 1,000 test takers for each exam. The CBP mandates that each customs business or entity that helps companies ship goods internationally employ at least one licensed broker. Brokers don't have to be physically located at each port. They file paperwork about the incoming cargo to the CBP electronically, and after the goods get cleared, they may also collect the tariffs from importers and pay the CBP. Pay for newly licensed customs brokers starts at around $75,000, and experienced brokers can make upwards of $250,000, DeFilippis estimated. Brokers say many of the questions seem designed to trip them up. Tutors say that that prepares them for the real world, where they might have to defend their rationale regarding duty payments from customs officials in various ports in the U.S. The high degree of difficulty. First-timers taking the notoriously difficult bar exam for lawyers generally have a higher pass rate, has spawned a cottage industry of tutors and online study groups for aspiring license holders. Following the customs exam, candidates also have to pass an interview and a background check. The first time DeFilippis took the exam, he missed the passing grade by 2 points. I protested, and they gave me one but not the other. It was gut-wrenching, said DeFilippis. For his second attempt, he hired a tutor, Rennie Alston, a New Jersey-based trade consultant, and passed it. Alston, who has been teaching for 30 years, said recent tariff changes show how valuable people with customs expertise are. His current class of 25 students, who will take the exam on Wednesday, started studying in December. Logistics service providers said they don't see artificial intelligence and other technology tools replacing customs brokers anytime soon. These tools are only as good as the input, and it is uncertain if they can discern intent, said Krish Iyer, vice president at EasyShip and an expert in e-commerce logistics. Iyer, who passed the exam in 2005, credits another broker's advice to not overthink the questions. He spent months studying for the exam. I was lucky that I was single at that time, said Ayer. And that concludes my light reading of the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, April 24th, 2025. My name is Kent, and I am a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds. Thank you for listening. It has been a pleasure reading to you today. And please stay tuned for more interesting programs here on Sun Sounds.